Okay, just taking a look at traffic and travel around the county, and it's a little bit heavy on the N7 heading in towards Dublin, but nothing major really to report there. It's picking up a little bit in between Castle Warden and Rathcoole. On the M4 then in towards Dublin again, it's a little bit heavy between Leixlip and Maynooth, but no accidents to report, just sheer traffic volumes of people returning to work on this Tuesday morning. And of course the schools are back this morning as well, so it's a little bit heavy in the major towns and villages around the county, particularly in Selbridge, where it's heavy on the Dublin Road and the Shackleton Road. In Clane, coming in from the Sallins side, it's heavy, and also out towards where the schools are on the Prosperous Road in the centre of Naas, and the approach from the Dublin Road and the Monreed Road and also the Sallins Road quite heavy, while out on the Kilcullen Road towards Piper's Hill it's heavy as well. In the centre of Newbridge, coming in from the Little Connell side at the Pfizer roundabout is quite heavy there, and also out towards the Curra. We mentioned that roadworks, of course, continuing in Athy, so it's heavy there in the middle of the town and coming in from the Kilkenny Road and the Carlow Road, and it's also busy in the centre of Kildare Town. Some of the messages that are coming in to us, and one here says, will you please wish my niece Kathleen Dunn from Derreens in Naas a very happy birthday. Lots of love from Anne-Marie, from Aunt Mary and all the family, and also from her mam. And could you also wish Mick Gorman, who's tuned in to us in Blessington, a very happy birthday. Lots of love from your two sisters, Anita and Mary, and your two brothers, Paul and Ben. Of course, if you want to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you this morning, 0833 97 97 97. And we start off with some music from George Ezra, and this is Hold My Girl.
I've been waiting for you to come around and tell me the truth, that everything that you're going through, my girl, you've got nothing to lose. Cold nights and Sunday mornings on your way out of the grave. I've got time, I've got love, got confidence, rise above. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Crowded town, silent bed, pick a place to rest your head. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Give me a minute to hold my girl. I've been dreaming about us, working hard and saving it up. We'll go and see the man on the moon. My girl, we've got nothing to lose. Cold nights and Sunday mornings on your way and out of the grave. I've got time, I've got love, got confidence, rise above. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Town, silent bed, be a good place to rest your head. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Give me a minute to hold my girl. My girl, my girl. It takes one hot second to turn. I've got love, got confidence, you rise above. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Crowded town, silent bed, pick a place to rest your head. Give me a minute to hold my girl. Give me
That's George Ezra and Hold My Girl here on Kildare's KFM. Now, my attention was drawn to an article written in the Journal over the last few days, and the first couple of lines are as follows. Imagine you're on your way to work, you're surrounded by shadows, and there's a strange fog in your eyes. You use your cane to navigate your surroundings. Imagine connecting with the sounds of the environment as you walk along the footpath. Some people are walking by, a car engine runs around and across the road. The reason that I'm mentioning this article is that on the line is Anne-Marie Carney. She's visually impaired. She's living down in Wexford and she joins us now. Good morning to you, Anne-Marie, and thanks for taking our call.
Good morning, Owen. Nice to be with you.
So this is in relation to e-scooters, which we'll come to in a moment, but you might tell us a little bit about yourself and your own story, Anne-Marie.
Well, my own story, I've been vision impaired since birth. I was totally blind and luckily they removed some of the cataracts from my eyes. I am lucky to be vision impaired. I'm only partially blind now, thank heavens. I've lived independently. My mum was fairly determined. I went to mainstream school, mainstream education. Now I work as a teacher and I travel independently. I've travelled solo around Europe, various countries in Europe, and I'm living an independent life and pretty happy. Vision impairment is only one corner of the page. It doesn't impede me in many ways. And when it does, I work hard to find ways to stop it doing so.
Okay, great. Like it's fantastic to hear, and it's great to hear such positivity, but obviously it does come with its challenges, Anne-Marie, and we mentioned e-scooters, which we'll get to in a moment, but what kind of daily challenges would you face as somebody who's visually impaired?
As somebody who's visually impaired, you've got to sometimes, you've got to do a bit more planning in order to do activities. For example, I would have to plan when I would travel to Europe on my own. I would have to do an awful lot more planning to make sure that things were accessible, to make sure that venues were accessible for me. I would need to, often take the coach trip where I can't just jump into the car. One of the most major challenges in Ireland is still transport. Public transport is simply non-existent in many rural areas in Ireland. It's a very big challenge. So I can go to England or I can go to Europe more easily than I can actually get to Waterford from Enniscorthy, which is ridiculous. Another challenge that you would have would be, I suppose, people, lack of awareness sometimes can still be an issue. People either think you're blind or you're fully sighted. There's kind of no room for the in-between a little bit sometimes, so there does need to be a little bit more of awareness of that. In terms of technology has been an absolute godsend to us. It's been amazing over the past 5 or 10 years. It's amazing. Like, I would use screen readers. Now, when I go in to teach my class, I would use my screen reader to read out my file, whatever I'm working with my students. Magnification on computers is amazing. Smartphones are absolutely amazing. The thing you can do now, it's ridiculous, the amount of advancement that there has been. It's amazing. I can now just take a picture of something and it will read out a document to me, my voice, whereas I would have been looking for my magnifier or magnification. It's amazing what you can do with it now. So the challenges in relation to access to information have been overcome. I used to be talking an awful lot about access to information, internet, technology and developments in that area have overcome that, but transport is still a major problem for people who are living outside the city. Anybody with a vision impairment is still totally isolated if they are living in a rural area.
Okay.
Due to lack of transport.
Now, the road traffic bill was on the Shannon agenda again. You said it presents the last opportunity for final amendments to be inserted to guarantee that some minimum safety standards apply to the use of e-scooters. And in your piece in the Journal, you also say that even the most independent and confident people with vision impairment are absolutely scared by the potential implications if this government does not ban e-scooters from travelling on footpaths. It probably goes without saying, but what are your concerns, Anne-Marie?
Well, my concern would be that they are silent objects, literally. Many of them are silent objects. My first experience of them was when I was in the United Kingdom in 2021, and I found myself on a street corner, just standing with some friends, and two of them were approaching me in the opposite directions, coming at about 25 or 24 kilometres per hour, coming at me silently. And luckily, I have the vision to actually step out of the way, but many people who are less independent and who have a more severe level of vision impairment would not have been able to do so. I'm independent, I'm not afraid to go around, and I wasn't afraid to shout and to say at the guys, look guys, pay more attention in future when you see a long cane. But there would be many people who are only recently disabled who would not have the confidence to do so. I was particularly stricken by one response that I got on a social media article when I mentioned it, that there is a woman who, she used to go independently to her job. She used to go to her job, and she is now afraid to walk the 10-minute journey, and she needs to get a taxi to her job because she's afraid of the silent e-scooters coming towards her on the path, and she's afraid of it, that a potential accident could be caused. So it's taking away people's independence. But I'm also amazed at the amount of response that I'm getting from able-bodied people. Mm. Able-bodied people are finding it a risk or finding it a challenge.
Yeah.
It's not just the vision impaired. People in wheelchairs are at risk. Anybody with any kind of vulnerability is at risk. Children are at risk with it. And also, fully able-bodied adults are actually scared of the things. I'm amazed at the amount of able-bodied people who are coming towards me, who are coming back to me and saying, wow, I was nearly struck by one myself.
Yeah, because that's the point I was going to make. I'd say there's people listening in to us this morning that are saying, I wouldn't be a fan of e-scooters on footpaths because of A, the speed that they can go, and B, as you say, because they're so silent, they can kind of just be up beside you within, you know, the space of seconds, and you haven't realised it. And maybe elderly people who are a little bit older on the footpaths would be, you know, frightened or, you know, discouraged from going out and walking on the footpaths. Do you think that the government are going to listen? Are they going to bring in some sort of rules or implications if people who have e-scooters use them on footpaths?
I honestly thought that the Senate would take a pause. I thought that they would take a pause, but apparently there were not too many senators at the debate last week about it. I did receive feedback from senators, you know, we look into the matter, but they didn't pause on it. I honestly thought that they would pause and reflect on the matter. You see, it's not, they're not for blind and vision impaired people. They're not just a challenge as they're moving. They're also a challenge when they're parked on the street. Or when they are just abandoned. There are other countries, and what has happened in other countries, for example, in Lanzarote, is they're just being thrown on the streets and blind and vision impaired people can trip over them. As well as that, in France at the moment, what's happening is they are reviewing the situation. Poorly planned parking or poorly planned rental schemes where the scooters are just being abandoned and literally just thrown into the River Seine. So they're actually reflecting on whether to abolish the rental schemes now, and they're going to have a vote on that in April in Paris, as to whether they are just going to abandon the rental schemes because the whole thing is just being abused. So for private use down in the countryside, okay, it's probably, well, everybody's responsible for their own vehicle, but in cities, in tourist areas, they could be just thrown all over our streets, and that's a vulnerability as well. It's not just when they're moving towards you, it's when they're abandoned or poorly placed, poorly parked.
What about the argument, Anne-Marie, and, you know, this is just coming from the other side of things in terms of what the alternative is if they're not on footpaths, where do e-scooters go? Because in European cities and countries, take for example Amsterdam or Paris or Berlin, any of these big cities, they have the infrastructure in place, very good cycle lanes, very good, you know, roads that could be used for e-scooters. We don't have that in Ireland, particularly outside the cities.
You see, a simple thing, what struck me about Amsterdam when I was there a number of years ago, when I was in Amsterdam, okay, they've got the infrastructure. It could be argued that it's very expensive to provide that in Ireland and we cannot do so. That could be an argument. But a simple thing that I noticed when I was in Amsterdam a number of years ago, everybody, when they saw my white cane, they rang a bicycle bell coming towards me. I felt so safe. Everybody was just ringing a bell. as they were coming towards me. A simple matter like that could be put in place. It could be absolutely, you have to have bell and ring it when you see a person with a white cane. That could be a simple thing that could be done. Now, there is already research going on. I know there's research going on in Italy and in Sweden and in the United Kingdom about sounds that can be added to e-scooters. So when those sounds and when that research is completed, it should be made obligatory that e-scooters have to have that sound. But for a simple solution in the meantime, it should be, and there should be awareness campaign. I would argue that government need to put in an awareness campaign, some kind of ad campaign. When you see this, ring this. You know, simple bell on your bike, basically. It's back to my mother's old argument. Where are you going with no bell on your bike? Where are you going with no bell or sound? Simple on your e-scooter.
Okay. On that, and just to give you some figures as well, Gardaí reported 1,373 traffic incidents with e-scooters involving 440 collisions, resulting in the deaths of two people and 42 being seriously injured. And that is Anne-Marie Kearney. She's from Wexford. She's visually impaired and she's calling for legislation to be brought in to ensure that e-scooters can't be used on footpaths. Thanks for joining us, Anne-Marie, and have a good week. And thanks again. That's Anne-Marie Kearney. I'd be interested to get your views on it. I think, you know, it's an interesting debate. And I think the point that was made there in terms of how Ireland compares to other countries in the EU. Are we moving too quickly? Some would say no. You know, they want, the government and all the experts wants to get us out of our cars. I think e-scooters are a way forward, sustainable travel. But do we have the infrastructure in place? If we can't use them on footpaths, where do we use them? Do we just use them on the road? Are they safe enough to use them on the road? Or should they be in cycle lanes? One message in here says, as they are silent and be upon you quickly, would she like to ban mobility scooters too? That's not the same. A mobility scooter is not the same as an e-scooter. These e-scooters can go 50 kilometres, 60 kilometres. Mobility scooters are essential for people who have to use them. And I'd be very surprised if a mobility scooter goes 60 kilometres an hour. We have to remember, Anne-Marie is visually impaired. She's saying it from a safety point of view that these scooters, you know, are flying and whizzing in and out of people like that. I don't think mobility scooters are doing the same thing. So I do think there is a difference. Anyway, keep those messages coming in to us. 0833 97 97 97.
Kildare Today with Owen Beattie.
With Whitewater Shopping Centre Newbridge, Ireland's largest regional shopping centre. Fashion, food, film, all under one roof in the heart of Newbridge. WhitewaterSC.ie.
Mag in Newbridge says if you cycle on a footpath, you can be fined €100. Didn't know that. And you also say, why should scooters be any different? They need to be on the road and not on footpaths. And speaking of paths, by the way, Mary in Rathangan has been in touch to say, and she sent a photograph in to say that heading down the footpath in Rathangan this morning is extremely dangerous. It seems as though the wall has collapsed there. And she just wants to know if Kildare County Council were notified or anyone has any information regarding that. We'll try and find out some information for you, Mary, but just if anybody else is in Rathangan, keep that in mind. The wall has partially collapsed there on the footpath heading down the village, so keep that in mind. And finally for now, the scooters need some kind of sound and it should be a legal requirement to make them visible to other road users. Every morning I watch several users on the Dublin Road in Naas, some on the road, some on the footpath, all have a tiny LED light on the front and back, and their users are dressed in black. For drivers, they must look like some sort of black shadows. And that comes in from Carissa. We'll come back to the messages in a few moments' time. First of all, though, John Wall is on the line again, air traffic controller at Shannon Airport, stage 4. He has stage 4 terminal prostate cancer. Good morning, John, and thanks for joining us again.
Oh, no, good morning to you. My pleasure.
Some listeners who were tuned into us on Friday will remember that we spoke to Trisha, a listener in Naas. She was struggling since last September or October to get a medical card for her husband, who was diagnosed with esophageal cancer that has spread into her lungs. We said that we would try and follow up and get some information and try and progress this, John. And you might tell us what happened after the show on Friday.
Sure, Owen, after the show, well, first of all, I had a quick chat with Tricia just to make sure it was okay, that what I was going to do, that I went ahead and did. And first of all, I put out a tweet, and it's got a bit of traction. HSE took, but I also used the connections that I have that I've built up over the years in the HSE to make a few phone calls and make this happen. Ultimately, what happened, I suppose, within hours after the interview on Friday, the medical card was approved. Now, whilst the HSE couldn't go into specific details with me, and for very good reason, I gave them the details that basically they needed to sort this out and to get in contact with the family to let them know that the card has been approved. It's a shocking state of affairs, really, when it takes a radio interview from Patricia to make this happen. It shouldn't be the case. I mean, she's been going through this process for months, herself and her family, just to try and get the card approved. And that application had stalled for whatever reason. I know there was issues with the home insurance and a minute discrepancy in monthly payments. But it should never be the case. And it should never take the intervention of a radio station, public representatives or patient advocates in order to get this done. But unfortunately, that's what had to happen on Friday last.
Yeah, now we spoke to Tricia on Friday and we've spoken to her again this morning. I understand she's got other commitments so she couldn't join us, but of course she's delighted now that the medical card has been approved, and we are as well, because I think it's only right that her husband starts to get the treatment that he needs and the help that he needs in that respect. But as you say, John, and you make that very important point, and I made this point on Friday, that you've, you know, been banging this drum for years, you've walked this path numerous times, that it shouldn't have to take this for a medical card to be issued to somebody with cancer.
No, and the problem we've had, Owen, for quite some time, it takes the intervention of public representatives and more increasingly patient advocates, or to create a social media presence or awareness about a particular issue. It takes that type of intervention in order to get some problems resolved. Admittedly, the medical card section are under extreme pressure at the moment for a whole host of reasons. It's the perfect storm, but that's absolutely no excuse. Common sense must prevail, and if there are going to be inordinate delays in any application, they must work with and very closely with the family, at least to explain what the delay is, why the delay is, and I know Patricia did not go public at the earliest opportunity. It was an absolute last resort for her. It's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's a very personal thing to do at a time when she could least afford or want to do it, but she did it nonetheless. And we have to ensure better communications from, I suppose, departmental and HSE levels down to the patient and their families, and that certainly did not appear to be the case in this case. I will be meeting with the department and the HSE on, I believe, our next meeting is March 1st, and it's exactly about this. It's about information and communications specifically relating to medical cards. And as you said, I'm banging that drum for a long time. Well, I'm going to continue banging the drum, and this particular issue will be raised in as much detail as I'm allowed to at that meeting, as citing just an example of what not to do and how not to do it. We've got to ensure that cases like this are avoided wherever possible. Mm. And for the most part, they should be. There's no excuse for it, none.
Okay, if I go back to a point that I raised with you as well on Friday, how far do you think we are away from people just automatically qualifying for a medical card when they find out they've been diagnosed with cancer? Because maybe you don't understand the way it works until you're in that situation. People may have had the perception that when you get cancer, you get a medical card, but that's not the case.
No, unfortunately not. It's far from the case. Whilst, you know, the eligibility criteria has improved over the last number of years, it's far, far from perfect. And it's still the 1970s Health Act. It's all about money. It's all about what you earn. It's all about a means test. But the means test is a seriously flawed system in that it's all relative to your outgoings. And myself, for example, I had a good wage, a terminal illness. It wasn't approved when I initially applied for it because it was means tested. But what I didn't take much into account is my outgoings. I have children in college, and things were really, really tight. There was a lot of treatments that I had to pay for at the time. And, you know, even GP visits rack up. They're significant. They're sizable bills. And as a result of my access to a medical card, it has made a significant, a huge difference to myself and my family. But for the most part, a lot of people with cancer, they're not, they don't have that automatic entitlement. It is in the programme for government, but that's only words. That's only words on paper. It means very, very little unless implemented. And I can see it at least being a few years off. However, in the interim, we need to keep pushing in order to get to that point, and where medical cards are now granted to people with a terminal illness have a prognosis of 2 years or less, and you have, I think, up to 400,000 GP visit cards about to be issued in April. It's a far cry from where we need to get to, but it's not also about issuing the cards. It's to ensure that the personnel are there to provide the services. That if you have the card, for example, with the GP visit cards, it's fine having a card, but if you can't get a GP, it's no good to you. So, the system has to work in tandem with the personnel that it has. And a headline statement saying that we're granting cards to, you know, a couple of 100,000 people, it doesn't work if those same people, those same patients can't get access to the services that they should be able to get with the card. So there's a huge amount, huge volume of work to be done, and a lot of it pertains to retention, staffing and retention within of staff within the recruitment and retention, I should say, of staff within the health service. It's at an all-time low, and it's creating, you know, havoc right across the public healthcare system. And until we deal with the root problems, I think any other issues such as the backlog in medical card applications and indeed the eligibility criteria for medical card applications is going to be a problem for some years to come. But all we can do is work towards and achieve that common goal.
As you said from the outset, John, it shouldn't have to take this, but we thank you for your help. And as soon as we got in touch with you, you were very obliging. And I know Tricia is very grateful as well for the help that you have given her. And we've gotten that medical card now for Tricia's husband, which is good news and a good outcome. And we wish her and her husband all the best. But again, as you said, John, it shouldn't have to take this. But thanks again, nonetheless, for coming on with us on Friday and this morning again, John.
Very welcome.
All right, thanks indeed. That's John Wall, air traffic controller with our at Shannon Airport. He himself has stage 4 prostate cancer, which is terminal. And if you were tuned into us on Friday, you will have heard Tricia, who was at her wit's end since September, October. She was trying to get that medical card for her husband that has esophageal cancer, which has spread now into his lungs. She couldn't get the medical card. We spoke to John on Friday morning, and we spoke to Tricia, and by Friday afternoon, the HSE had approved the medical card. That's how simple it was. And that's, the impact that John has and the impact that Tricia had in coming on and speaking out about it. And as always, if there's anything that we can help you with, or at least try to help you with, we'd love to do so. 0833 97 97 97, you can get in touch with us. We're going to be catching up on those messages, as I said, in a few moments. First of all, though, let's go to Fine Gael councillor on the Claymaunuth Municipal District, and that is Brendan Wise. Good morning, Brendan, and thanks for joining us.
Morning, Owen.
Local issues that you've been raising with the council recently, Brendan. And first of all, if we go to the Carberry area and around Milerstown, you wanted a weight restriction or weight restriction signs to be brought in at all junctions on the local roads around the Milerstown and Carberry sweep area. Are you going to get those?
We're not sure yet. We have to go out and meet. But I'll tell you where the location is on. If you're going from Carberry towards Johnstown Bridge, the first crossroads you meet, that's Carberry Sweep. And if you look to the north there, that junction, it's very deceiving because it has two lanes there. But very quickly, as you go down it, it ends up being one lane, and then it goes into a fork with two country lanes. And I'm out there a number of times monitoring this, and I saw an articulated truck from Wales coming down. Now, it's possible he was going down there to a business or a farm, but it's also possible that Google Maps is sending these lorry drivers down, and if they look from the road, it looks like it's a wide road, but very quickly becomes a narrow road. And it was raised by a group of residents at a meeting in the Hamlet Court Hotel in Johnstown Bridge a few weeks ago, and two actions came out of that, and Councillor Dara Fitzpatrick had an action to invite that group into the chamber, council chamber, give a presentation, and then I looked for these weight restriction signs. And Owen, they're open to putting up signage that would warn these lorries, and it's just about getting the right signs, and that's where this meeting on the ground will decide what would be the best signs. The council engineers seem to favour something along a width sign or a narrow road narrowing sign, but I still think a weight restriction would be the way to go, because then anything over a certain weight shouldn't really be going down these country lanes unless you have a need to get into a farm, as I say there.
Okay, is there an issue with road safety around Clotheringo National School, Brendan?
Well, there definitely is, Owen, and again, something I would have monitored in the past. It's a very confined area around that school with a housing estate straight across the road. And they're lucky enough to have a school bus service, but it's large coaches coming in. And they see the coaches trying to manoeuvre and then children trying to walk and cycle to school and then with cars dropping off. It just looks a little bit chaotic to me. And I know we did great work with NTA funding in Derren Turn last year. And while that was ongoing, I said we need to look at Clotheringo for next year. But it looks like that same funding from the NTA for active schools isn't going to be available this year. And it's a real pity because we got great work out of it in Derren Turn, and then there was some other work done, look at bollards and markings at Killinagh School in Bradford, and there was funding from the roads programme for that. So there's still an option there on to try and get something done, but definitely, as I say, it's a confined area with a lot happening, and something could be done there or needs to be done.
Okay, a couple of weeks ago we spoke to Paddy Maguire. He's the chairman of the Bradford Area Residents Association, and he and Larry Malone and other residents around Bradford were raising the issue of Mullins Turn, particularly when it's icy. They said it was lethal, and the amount of accidents that had happened there over the recent icy spell that we had. You raised this with the council.
I did, because I was listening to Paddy Maguire on your programme of the Bradford Area Residents Association, and I know Paddy well, and he's doing great work out there, and I really trust his judgement on items like this. And he showed me a bridge not too far away from there, Clonduff Bridge, where we put some anti-skid servicing, and he showed me that bend on, and that's why my question here was, I would have thought that the council would have addressed this by now. And from the reply I got, they didn't seem to be aware of the serious nature here. So again, I went out there at the weekend and I parked up, and it wasn't long after a big shower of rain, and I noticed that the sections on road either side of the bend were relatively dry, not long after the shower, as you'd expect, and this area is remaining damp. So you have trees overlooking it, the slope or the camber of the road is very unusual, I would say, and water doesn't seem to be running off it, and there is a gully there, but it's not doing the job. So the council report to me was about de-icing it, but I said in the meeting, that's not what I want here. I want this to be prevented from being iced up in the first place. And there's something happening here, as I say, with the nature of the road at the bend, that ice is forming on it. And it's deceiving for people to come from the dry roads into the bend, where all of a sudden it's slippery. So I 100% agree with Paddy Maguire that something needs to be done, and the engineer will go out and assess this bend. But I can't tell you what the action will be on. I can only tell you that from my point of view, it's definitely dangerous because it's remaining damper than it should be.
Okay, on those range of local issues that were brought forward to the council, that is Brendan Wise, Fine Gael councillor on the Claymaneuth Municipal District. Thanks for your time this morning, Brendan. Now, Fianna Fáil councillor Anne Connolly on the Kildare Newbridge Municipal District has been in touch with us regarding Mary's message in Rathangan, where there's a part of the wall there has collapsed out onto the footpath. Anne Connolly says that she has notified Kildare County Council about that part of the wall. It's on the bridge in Rathangan, and they will be out soon in order to make it safe. So thanks for that update, Anne, and thanks Mary for bringing it to our attention as well. Michelle has been in touch to say, morning all, just wanted to let you know how disappointed I was to hear a friend went over to the Kildare Cork match after a last minute change of plans. I was not allowed to pay in at the gate, either by cash or card, was told it was ticket only. St Conlett's wasn't full at the time. Do the GAA want people at matches? Asks Michelle. Unfortunately, Michelle, and we've raised it here previously, that is the way that the matches are being run at the moment. Tickets are on sale in participating Centra and Super Value stores around Kildare. You can buy them in the lead up to the game, but in terms of buying a ticket for the match kind of on the day, it has to be done online. And I know people have raised that and they've raised concerns about it, but you can't pay in cash or by card by going up to the turnstiles. It has to be done online, unfortunately. Another one here, Tom T, in relation to the e-scooters, says they can legislate for e-scooters, but like many other laws, we haven't the resources to enforce them. G says that is just ridiculous. If they were able to give the medical card to that lady when we intervened, why couldn't they just give it to her from the start? It's still the case in this country, isn't it, of who you know, and it just goes that to show to the powers that be it's never going to change, says G. And finally for now, one here says, when I was receiving cancer treatment, chemo, the hospital automatically and without delay applied for my medical card over the phone. However, the month I received my final chemotherapy, the medical card was cancelled. And that comes in from a listener. We won't mention their name, but keep those texts coming in to us. Lots more coming up after this short break. Now, the Reserve Defence Forces could cease to exist within 3 years without a drastic intervention from the government. That's the stark warning from the Reserve Defence Force Representative Association amid claims the backup to the country's ever-dwindling permanent defence forces is even more critically endangered than the regulars. And joining me now is General Secretary of the RDFRA, the Reserve Defence Forces Representative Association, Neil Richardson. Good morning, Neil.
Morning.
How bad is this situation at the moment, Neil?
It's in a pretty dire state at the moment because, I mean, we've been reporting recently that approximately 750 Army reservists and about 60 Naval Service reservists undertook some form of paid training last year, which can be taken to be the approximate effective numbers left within the force. And the Army Reserve should have about 3,800 and the Naval Service 200. So we're below 20% of what we should have. And it's getting to the point where even if we were able to recruit significant numbers of new people in order to sort of re-inject that lifeblood into the force, we'd be hard-pressed to find instructors left within the reserve to actually train these new people. So it really is a very bad state we're in.
Okay, we've spoken to Conor King from RACO, of course, Mark Keen and Ger Guinan from PD Fora, and we've heard a lot about this Commission on the Defence Forces report, which was compiled just over a year ago. And it seems as though a lot of the targets that were set out and recommendations set out in that report haven't been implemented yet.
Agreed. And from a reserve perspective, it's similarly bad. I mean, the commission report was released on the 9th of February last year, so we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary. And that was then translated into a list of projects, and some of them were identified as essential early actions. So if the reversals of, or if the reserve situation needs to be reversed immediately, what needs to be implemented straight away? And it identified two key projects. One was the creation of a governing body that would sort of manage and take care of the reserve specifically, and that was earmarked for set up by August of 2022. And then that body was due to draft a regeneration plan for the reserve to get things going, and that report was due to be initiated, or that plan was due to be drafted by December of 2022. And at the moment, neither of them have come into existence. And indeed, any documentation we've seen says that they won't come into existence until at least April, which unfortunately leaves the implementation date quite open-ended, because the saying that they will come in by the start of April, or they may come in by the start of April, is not saying that they will. So as we get forever smaller, the early actions that were identified by the commission report to save us are disappearing ever more into the future.
Tell me a little bit about the issues then in terms of recruitment. And I don't mean that from the point of view that there's no people applying to join the Reserve Defence Forces, but kind of from an administrative point of view, it's proving difficult to get people in, is it?
Very much so. And obviously, we're very different than the Permanent Defence Forces insofar as most of our members, if not the vast majority of our members, would have civilian employment outside. So paying conditions, while obviously of concern to our association, isn't the main reason people join the reserves. So as you rightly said, we generally have a very high number of applications whenever our recruitment portal is open. The problem is that the PDF, and you alluded to the fact you've spoken to Conor King and Ger Guinan, and I'm sure they mentioned this, the PDF are so under strength and double and treble jobbing that they often can't find the time to turn to the administration of RDF recruitment simply because they've so much else on their plate. But in the key area of medical resourcing, we're finding that that's a serious bottleneck for us, insofar as we have hundreds of recruits who are looking to join the force, but understandably they need to be medical first to make sure that they're fit and healthy to join. But because the Defence Force is under-resourced and not in a position to actually provide those medicals, we simply have to tell these recruits to, you know, stand fast. And at some point in the dim and distant future, we may be in a position to provide you with an entrance medical. Some will go the course and they will wait. A lot will ultimately lose interest and they may drift off to some other organisation or another voluntary organisation that will take them in an awful lot quicker. So while we may have high numbers of applications, we can't test these people or get them processed. And medical resourcing is obviously a serious key one.
Okay, if we go back then and just to finish up where we started, Neil,
sure.
We said that within 3 years you're saying that the Reserve Defence Forces could seek to exist or could cease to exist without intervention from the government. Why do you say that and what needs to be done in the meantime?
Well, for example, we lose 100, if not 200 people a year due to retirements on age grounds. And last year, despite all the efforts that were put in, we attested or enlisted 85 new people. So the math simply doesn't add up in that we're losing these experienced people because obviously they're reaching retirement age. And we're not getting enough to replace them at entry level. So we're going to reach a point, and we're on the cusp of it now, but within a couple of months we're going to see that even if we had huge numbers of new recruits, we can't find experienced instructors to train them. And obviously because the PDF are in the situation they're in, they're not going to be able to lend us their instructors. So it becomes a sort of a zero-sum game where we can't train these new people, which means we can't take them in. And it'll get to the point where if in 3 years' time we estimate there could be between 150 and 200 reservists left nationwide, and that will, those individuals will not be able to achieve anything, so the reserve will be well and truly dead at that stage.
All right. With that pretty stark warning, it has to be said, that's Neil Richardson, General Secretary of the Reserve Defence Force Representative Association. Thanks for your time this morning, Neil, and good morning to you. Be interested to get your views on that and what needs to be done. And how important do you think the Reserve Defence Forces are in terms of the Defence Forces that we have here, the so-called permanent Defence Forces here in Ireland? 0833 97 97 97. And finally, for now, May has been in touch to say, thank God that woman got her medical card for her husband. Hopefully the HSE will fast track that for everyone now that's suffering from cancer.